Please consider supporting your public radio station with a tax-deductible contribution before the end of the year. How much should you give? Well, of course, you decide what's affordable for you. Some listeners give a dollar a week, and some give a dollar a day. Your contribution in any amount will help cover the cost of broadcasting the in-depth news and information you listen to all year. Please renew your membership today or become a friend of WILO for the first time by calling 217-244-9455 or give online at willpledge.org.
It's 2:41 on the Afternoon Magazine. In sports and Big Ten basketball tonight, Illinois will try to improve on a 10-1 record as it meets number 25 Missouri in St. Louis. Illinois has won 19 of the 27 games played in that annual matchup, including the last eight. The leading receiver for third-ranked Texas has been granted a sixth year of eligibility by the NCAA. Third-team AP All-American Jordan Shipley missed the 2004 and 2005 football seasons because of knee and hamstring injuries. Alabama's Nick Saban is the Associated Press College Football Coach of the Year for the second time. It follows up on his 2003 award while heading up the LSU program. Texas Tech's Mike Leach was the runner-up in balloting by an AP media panel that votes in the weekly poll. U.S. swimmer Michael Phelps is the choice as the AP's Male Athlete of the Year. His eight gold medal performance in Beijing, now known as the Great Hall of China, is the AP's top sports story of last year. The University of Illinois tennis player has lost his attempt to overturn an NCAA reprimand. The organization punished Ryan Rowe for what it calls unsportsmanlike conduct in a doubles match during the NCAA men's tennis tournament last season. And the slumping St. Louis Blues are taking on the mighty Red Wings tonight in NHL action in Detroit. The Red Wings are currently leading the NHL Central Division, while St. Louis is dead last in the same division. And that's a look at sports.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming 2009 with three opportunities in January to enjoy the Russian National Ballet Theater, performing the timeless story, Sleeping Beauty. More information is at KrannertCenter.com.
It's 2:42. The term going green might conjure up thoughts of cutting-edge technology, such as biofuels, but there's another green technology that's as old as the planet itself, and it's a key feature at a new building going up at Western Illinois University in Macomb. Illinois Public Radio's Nick Wilkins reports.
Western Illinois University is a busy place. In addition to the normal hustle and bustle of campus, there's a major construction project going on. Perhaps more significant than the new multicultural building itself is what's underneath it.
They're about 425 feet deep total, or each well, and there's about 26 of them.
That's Ted Renner. He's a construction project manager for the school. And no, the university is not drilling for oil, though it might look like it. These wells are for a geothermal heating and cooling system. Renner says Western chose to install the system in an effort to go green and to save some green.
The system that we're putting in the ground will pay for itself over an 8 to 10 year period.
Geothermal energy is arguably the oldest heating and cooling system on Earth. It's rooted in the days when early humans took shelter from extreme temperatures by going into underground caves. Dr. Roger Valladaro is director of Western's Institute for Environmental Studies. He says even though most people don't live in caves today, the concept behind geothermal energy is essentially the same. He says it works a lot like the radiator on a car.
What you're doing is trying to take the heat out of the air and transfer that into your house. Now, if it's really, really cold, it gets more difficult to pull heat out of the air. So the idea with the geothermal energy is actually to do that heat transfer in the ground.
Valladaro says having this transfer underground offers a huge advantage.
The ground temperature remains approximately constant year-round.
So during the winter, when it's 15 degrees outside, it's actually more like 55 underground. Likewise, when it's 90 during the summer, it's still around 55 underground. Valladaro says technology has improved the system.
National Weather Service in Chicago has issued a winter storm warning for sleet and freezing rain, which is in effect until 12 noon Wednesday. The winter weather advisory is no longer in effect. Warm air in the lower layers of the atmosphere will continue to push north late this afternoon and this evening. This warm air will cause a mixture of sleet and freezing rain to continue into this evening. The precipitation will decrease in coverage and intensity overnight with another period of sleet or freezing rain Wednesday morning. Total sleet accumulations of 1/2 inch or more along with ice accumulation of 1/4 inch or more are possible by late Wednesday morning. The wintry precipitation may change over to light rain or drizzle before ending late Wednesday morning. A winter storm warning means significant amounts of snow, sleet, ice, or strong winds are expected or occurring. This will make travel very hazardous or impossible. If you must travel, keep an extra flashlight, food, and water in your vehicle in case of an emergency.
Geothermal systems need a lot of land for installation of the underground infrastructure. He also says certain places are not suited for the technology.
You obviously couldn't, or well, you shouldn't be drilling a bunch of holes and then running a bunch of plumbing through a place that has a high groundwater table.
Valladaro says cost is another factor.
The upfront cost definitely is higher than more traditional systems. It's the labor and the materials, because again, you're burying pipes in the ground. That has a lot of inherent limitations, and anytime you go do something in the ground, you never know exactly what you're going to hit.
One more possible setback is the building itself. Brian Waller, who owns the heating and cooling business, says it's cheaper and easier to install a geothermal system in a new home versus trying to retrofit one into a building that has an existing conventional system. Despite these limitations, it appears as if policymakers would like to see more geothermal systems. Illinois offers grants of up to $50,000 for nonprofits and public institutions to install such systems. Waller says there are some federal incentives for homeowners as well.
A homeowner can deduct, it's up to 30% of the install cost or a cap of $2,000. And it's just going to be a line item on our 2008 taxes, and they made it retroactive back to the first of the year.
Once a geothermal system is installed, the average person might never notice it. There are no large solar panels or towering wind turbines stretching skyward. But the next time you think of going green, you might consider what's under your feet. I'm Nick Wilkins reporting.
The following is a required weekly test of the emergency alert system. This has been a test of the emergency alert system. This is WILL Urbana.
The New York Times has covered a lot of news since its inception back in 1851. A collection of their front pages is compiled in a new book called The New York Times, The Complete Front Pages, 1851 to 2008. It's published by Black Dog and Leventhal Publishers of New York. Some choice dates are featured in this rather large book. The rest can be found in the three DVDs that come with the book. AM 580's Jim Meadows talked with Sam Tannenhaus, the editor of the New York Times Book Review and The Week in Review. Tannenhaus wrote the essay covering 1929 to 1939 in the book. Jim Meadows started the conversation off by talking about a copy of the New York Times that he's kept at his desk.
It is the New York Times National Edition. The date is September 12, 2001. The headline, as you might imagine, U.S. attacked, hijacked jets destroy Twin Towers and hit Pentagon and Day of Terror. Well, we all know why that day and that news story are significant to us. It's perhaps a little more difficult to explain why a newspaper front page sums it all up for us. But this front page is one of more than 50,000 New York Times front pages now collected in a book and a DVD ROM set called The New York Times, The Complete Front Pages, 1851 the 2008. It's published by Black Dog and Leventhal Publishers of New York. And Sam Tannenhaus of the New York Times Book Review and Week in Review is one of the people who worked on that collection. Good afternoon, Sam.
Hi, nice to be with you.
And I wanted to ask you, Sam, what do you think is so fascinating about a newspaper front page?
Well, it's a kind of snapshot of the world at that moment, particularly a paper like The Times, which has always had, or for many years has had, an international focus. It is a way of summing up, and of course you can't get everything in, what that moment in time looks like. Now, some of this has changed with the advent of the web, but particularly in the days when people got their newspapers every morning, when there were 6 or 8 or 10 newspapers being published each day in a city like New York, each one kind of offered a competing version of what had happened the day before, and in a way it kind of creates order for us. Even if you've heard about the event. Everybody knows, you know, what happened on September 11th. We didn't need the New York Times to tell us, but somehow it frames it and gives it a kind of focus and coherence and helps us make more sense of it.
Now, that's changed over the years, and you can see, I guess, a real difference between the New York Times as it presents the news today compared to the way it did, say, in the early 20th century, and especially compared to the way it did in the 1850s.
It's true. I mean, if you go back and look at it, it almost seems the front page looks like a series of classified ads almost. There are no images at all. There are several short paragraphs with small headlines. It's just columns and columns of type. Because in those days, you know, the technology was not nearly so advanced. And the idea was that it was almost a kind of bulletin, the paper. Another interesting thing to see about the Times is that those of us who work here and others, too, often think of it as the newspaper of record. For a long time, it really wasn't. It was just one of many newspapers that evolved, discovered its identity over time. And that identity is always changing and we hope improving. But you're absolutely right. The early New York Times is kind of shocking to look at. You wonder how anybody could get through it.
Now, you wrote an essay for this collection on the New York Times in the front pages from 1929 to 39. Your essay is called Centralizing the Power. You're looking at the Roosevelt years, at the Depression, at the years leading up to World War II. What did you find out about that time just from looking at those New York Times front pages?
Well, there were a number of surprising things. One is that Herbert Hoover, whom we think of as this kind of either villain or dupe or clueless president, actually was doing everything he could. The problem was, at the very beginning of the Great Depression, he really didn't have a clue what to do, and he kept hoping everything would somehow improve. And what happened is events got away from him, and we've seen this happen with presidents since. It's interesting, when I wrote that essay, it was probably a year and a half ago or something, and no one had any idea that Wall Street would be imploding the way it did now. The other thing that was interesting for me was to see that although Franklin Roosevelt's election in 1932 was this tremendous repudiation of Hoover, and Roosevelt won in the kind of landslide we can scarcely imagine today. You know, we think of Barack Obama's victory in November as being decisive, and it was. He won 53% of the vote, some 365 electoral college votes. Roosevelt won 57.5% of the vote and 42 out of 48 states. So it was a massive landslide. But what was interesting to me was everybody knew it was coming. Because if you look at the returns of the off-year elections, the congressessional elections of 1930, which the New York Times covered naturally on its front page, those victories for the Democrats were already seen as presaging a change of power in the White House, very similar to what happened in 2006 when Congress changed hands here. So what you see are kind of predictions. You see patterns in the way politics worked, in the way reputations fluctuated, that are very similar and kind of resonate today.
You talk, you spoke a few moments ago about how the New York Times was just one of several competing presentations of the news with all the other newspapers in New York City. Did the New York Times, as a paper, have a particular slant or take that you could see on its front page on, say, FDR's New Deal, or whether the U.S. should get into the war in Europe?
Great question. The Times, like so many newspapers back then, this may come as a surprise to some listeners, was actually quite conservative. Most of the major newspapers in America were anti-Roosevelt and anti-New Deal on their editorial pages. The daily coverage tended to be more neutral, as it should have been. One of the big distinctions that people quarrel about today is that in the earlier period, the period we're talking about, news coverage was presented in a different way. It was almost a stenographic record. If a president like Roosevelt or Hoover gave a press conference, all the newspaper did essentially was report what he said. Nowadays, you see a kind of interpretation and scene setting. There's a sort of mood and atmosphere to even the regular news reporting that would never have been allowed then. So if you go back and look at the New York Times' front page from that period, you have no sense what its political position might be. But in the overall spectrum of papers, the Times was kind of in the middle. There was a great classic Republican paper, the Herald Tribune, which now exists only as a foreign newspaper published in English, owned by the Times now and published in Paris. The Herald Tribune was the voice of East Coast Republicanism in that period. And the New York Post, for those of you who are familiar with it and think of it now as a very conservative paper owned by Rupert Murdoch, was then a very liberal publication. There was the New York Daily News, which still exists. That was somewhat more conservative. The Post and News have kind of flopped identities in recent years. And then there were papers people don't even think about that have vanished altogether. Probably the greatest newspaper from that period was the New York World, which was edited by Walter Lippmann, who was the premier journalist and pundit of that era. That was a greater newspaper in the 30s than the New York Times.
If this book is, say, updated 20 years from now with another 20 years of New York Times front pages, what role do you imagine a newspaper front page will be playing by that time, considering the advent of the internet and TV?
I thought about that a lot because we, at the Times, now have roughly as many online readers as we do newsprint readers. And you know yourself, I'm sure you're a journalist, and many of your listeners know this too, there is no fixed front page online. It's changing constantly. So I don't know actually how you capture that. In the course of a 24-hour cycle, the New York Times' front page may go through half a dozen different iterations as news, not only as news is reported, news stories come in, but the location, the placement of stories is changing constantly. So I really don't know what it would look like. You might not be able to do it in this form, is my guess. Now, we still think here at the paper, I'm sure all newspapers do, that the print edition we publish for the next morning is the kind of final draft of what we've put together. But the fact is, the majority of readers may have looked at some earlier draft, so there's not the same one-to-one correspondence between what all those millions of people have read and what we would have on the print edition at a particular moment. Even after September 11th, you know, you are very wise to choose the September 12th headline. That even feels as if it comes from a period when the print edition of the newspaper was set in a kind of stone. That simply doesn't exist anymore.
Well, these front pages still exist in this book and DVD-ROM set, The New York Times, the complete front pages, 1851 to 2008. It's a very big book with three DVD-ROMs. And Sam Tannenhaus, one of the people who worked on it, thank you very much for talking.